Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Tet Vav Amud Bet. That is 15b3. And if you remember the last subject that we studied, in which we finally, even though at a late hour, concluded, was about the question of whether sexual relations were permitted for the mourner, the person under the ban, and then finally for a person who is a mitzorah. So we finished that. Now we are on 15b3 on the right side, toward the bottom, first paragraph in the English side of the page. It brings up a subject that, at least for practical reasons, has no practical relevance. It is the question of whether a mourner can participate in the normal religious ritual of the sacrificial system to the extent that a person can. So here the question asks is, Avel, or it's not a question, it's a statement, Avel eino mishaleach korbanotav. A mourner does not send his korbanot, his sacrifices. Now, when would a person send sacrifices? What is the meaning of that? In fact, under normal circumstances, people don't bring sacrifices.
Holidays.
Maybe holidays, but even on the holidays, we think of sacrifice in terms of people, that this was something people were directly involved in, directly participating in and all the time. Well, there's a truth to that, but it's not exactly the way we tend to think of it. We think of it as a fulfillment of a religious obligation. Well, there's some truth to that too, but it's not, again, not exactly what we think. It's not as if, for example, you have to daven Shacharit, Mincha, and Maariv, right? You have to daven Shacharit, Mincha, and Maariv. Do you have to bring a sacrifice morning, afternoon, and evening?
No. Depends if the rabbi is hungry.
No. You don't have to bring it. You don't have to bring it, okay? Sacrifice is, as we would say it, is a free will offering. It's a free will offering. And in fact, what that is called in Hebrew is shlamim. Shlamim. When you bring a sacrifice, when a normal person brings an offering, it is called a shlamim. It is a sacrifice that is a free will offering. And that can be for a variety of reasons. Most commonly, it's a todah. A todah is a thanksgiving offering. Right? You bring a shlamim, which is a todah, and you have some reason to say thanks to God. You were ill and you got better. You were on a trip and there was danger and you passed through without any danger, okay? Without any harm. Precisely the same reasons that we say the Birkat HaGomel. If you're ill and you get better, you come up for an aliyah, and you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, HaGomel L'chayavim Tovot She'gemalani Kol Tov. Blessed is God, who takes the person who might have had chovot, that is to say, who might have been punished, and has simply rewarded him instead and given him good things. So that's the way we think of it. So that is the shlamim. That is the shlamim.
Sin offerings don't they fit where?
Sin offering is possible, but actually doesn't fit here. Doesn't fit here because to the extent that there is an obligatory offering, that's probably not what we're talking about. Probably not. Because there is a volitional side to what we are saying here that's crucial. Right? Because remember, it's not at all clear that any of these laws, and we can look at the language particularly of this one, that this is from the Torah. And the Torah will, in certain circumstances, require a sin offering. right? And therefore you have to bring it. So that wouldn't be a question. Of course you'd have to bring the sin offering even if you are a mourner, okay? Here it is, avel eino mishalech. It doesn't even say asur lishloach. Doesn't say that he's prohibited, right? It just says that he does not do it. Not even that it's not coming, it's not done. It's not done. It's not done. So that there's an implied prohibition, but it's not of the force of a regular prohibition as we're used to usually reading these things. Either lishalem or lihiyot shalem. Mm-hmm. Okay? It is either lishalem, which is to pay, or to be shalem complete.
Closure.
Complete. Now, it could be that lishalem and shalem is the same thing. Because when you pay for something, you complete the transaction, let's say. Right? You complete the obligation that you have to pay for it. Right? So it's all connected, I think.
Yeah, but I wonder if this was like part of the dues to the community.
No, it's not, because especially this is a free will offering.
It was always a free will offering.
So shalamim are always free will offerings. The only time you can say it's not free will is if you make a vow. Shlamim are also nedavot, a nedava. If you make a vow, you say, I am going on this trip, and if I come back in one piece, I will bring a shlamim. But that's a nedava, actually. But a nidava is a type of shlamim. Nidava meaning a vow offering. And that's a type of shlamim. Okay. So here we're reading about the person that he doesn't bring a shlamim. Doesn't bring the shlamim. Ditanya. And here we have a baraita which will explain to us why. And I'm interested in the explanation. Rabbi Shimon Omer. Rabbi Shimon says, shlamim... You bring the shlamim bizman shehu shalem velo bizman shehu onen. Very nice. Right? The name of the offering is a shlamim, a peace offering, or a whole, we use that today, wholeness. It's a very popular word in New Age type religion. Right, we are, or in popular Christianity today, and then to New Judaism, the popular Jewish stuff. How this is the same thing. We are seeking wholeness in our religious life. Now, that's I don't know how to. There's no other way to say it.
Wholeness.
I don't know, but that's popular. That's what people are looking for: wholeness in their spiritual lives. Right, instead of. Partiality or incompleteness in our healthcare chaplaincy. I got a doctor that I go to. Suddenly, I get a big envelope from the doctor today. A bill that I didn't pay, you know, or the price just went up. You know, that's what I figured. So with bated breath, I open up this envelope to see what's awaiting me. And lo and behold, it's a newsletter of the hospital where I was presenting the Wholeness of Life Award to some person on the hospital staff. The Wholeness of Life is the healthcare chaplaincy's annual awards to the hospitals are called the Wholeness of Life awards. I'm telling you, this is very in religious language today. It's very in religious language. So here it's nice. Shlamim, you bring a shlamim bizman shehu shalem at a time when a person is complete. All right, velo bizman shehu onen, and not when a person is an onen. Now an onen, strictly speaking, is before the actual avelut. It's before mourning. But it is used here, and the assumption is obviously in the Gemara that it would be the same at the beginning, you know, right after the death, and this same state of affairs would continue throughout the mourning period. Okay? Now, I want you to look and see two commentaries on Shalem here. Let's see if I can find this. First is the pseudo-Rashi. I just want you to get a sense of the psychology of how the halacha in the sacrificial system is functioning with the inner psychology. And some of it is just obvious. If you see here, it says, Lefichach nikraim shlamim. It's not exactly, you can see that this so-called Rashi had a slightly different text than our text. Therefore, they are called shlamim. Bizman shehu shalem, in a time when he is complete, and then the pseudo Rashi fills it out. Shalem bidda'ato. Shidda'ato miyushevet alav. Now, bidda'ato means in his mind, literally, that his mind is composed. Okay? In other words, you bring a shlamim when you feel like you're of sound mind. And when you are mourning, you're not composed. You're not shalem. You're not da'ato eina miyushevet alav. Okay? Now, that's one way of looking at it. I want you to also see a slightly different perush in the Rashi manuscript. Look down in the Rashi manuscript. This is, the Rashi manuscript actually grows in three stages. It's narrow, then it expands, and then it expands even more, just on the page here. If you'll see the first expansion, four lines down, it says, Kishahu Shalem. Kishahu Shalem. I can't read it without the magnifying glass. Shalem b'simcha ne'echal. Shlamim are eaten b'simcha, in an atmosphere of joy. Right? V'avel eino shalem. Right? An avel is not shalem, doesn't have joy, in effect. Doesn't participate in the atmosphere of joy. Okay? And I think there's a subtle difference between these two explanations. On the one hand, the way I read it is that the first explanation really is directed at the mourner, totally. Okay? The mourner, dato eina miyushevet alaf. Right? He's not, his mind isn't composed. And the second one, I see it really as slightly different. I see it as it's stronger, because it's talking not about just feeling okay, but of being joyful. And I think that implied here also is that when you bring shlamim, you are involved in a communal joy. You're sharing your joy with other people. That's what happens, in fact. Because you bring the offering, you don't eat the offering yourself. Particularly if it's a todah. When you bring a todah, you remember how many breads you have to bring with a todah?
7? 40.
You have to bring 40 loaves of bread, 10 of which are leavened bread. 30 loaves of unleavened bread and 10 loaves of leavened bread when you bring a todah. One todah requires 40 loaves of bread. Now just, I mean, it's fascinating because in essence, what you have to do is sponsor the Kiddush. That's the idea. Obviously, this is the original source of sponsoring the Kiddush. You have something good happen to you, and so you bring the offering. That clearly is, that's an act of thanks to God, because it's done in this sacred context. But then the reality is that you and a whole bunch of other people are enjoying it because you have to bring with it 40 loaves. It's all part of the requirement. Okay? So there, I think the sense is that the mourner, when participating in the shlamim, is part of a religious rite, which is almost a festival. It's a very happy kind of a thing to do. And the other piece here of the mourner is that the mourner turns a happy environment into a sad one. Because people feel uncomfortable with the mourner. And people don't really... The mourner, everybody knows a mourner should be mourning. And therefore, there is, I think, the sense of the mourner being just at a place, in this place. And that's what I think is subtly in the Rashi manuscript. Not clearly there, but I think it's subtly there.
Doesn't that contradict, though, what we learned some weeks ago about a mourner observing Yom Tov so as not to diminish the experience for the community?
But remember, this is voluntary. The Shlamim is voluntary. And therefore, we say, you don't have to do it. Yeah, he doesn't have to do it. Yom Tov is mandatory for everybody. Okay? This, that's a good example because I think you can see the contrast between the two. This is a totally voluntary situation. And since it is voluntary, one withdraws from those voluntary situations.
So is this the model for all of the voluntary things that you might do to celebrate things that you shouldn't
yes,
do?
Yes, that's one of the reasons. That's
like going to a wedding. And
exactly,
all the
exactly. This is subtly, I think, really what you see here. You know, on the one hand, it's I introduce this by saying this is totally irrelevant. But, because we don't bring shlamim. When's the last time you brought a shlamim?
We do bring
shlamim. But that's the point. Exactly. The point is that the reality is that these things still exist, but they've turned into metaphors. This is a metaphor, and the reality is that ritual exists in metaphor. Metaphor really is the way that ritual functions, particularly ritual that functions in response to grief. Right? There are a variety of metaphors, and therefore the metaphor of the Shlamim is perfect in so many ways. And it really serves, I think, as the basis, even though it'll be a subtle basis, for so many of the practical things that we do, or that we don't do, because so much of it has to do with sort of gauging what's happy and what's not happy. And that's the force, I think, of the Rashi manuscript here, to bring in that whole concept.
Or a little bit aside, Avel, Rashai Lalechet Lebrit Mila.
It depends who's Brit Mila.
You know, they say if you hear that you have a Brit Mila, it's a mitzvah to go.
Then you're not supposed to go. If it's your own child's Brit Mila, you have to go, because it's a mitzvah for you. But if it was somebody else, then you wouldn't go. Right? Because it's a simcha. It's a simcha.
Yeah, but I know it's a simcha, but it's a mitzvah being that simcha. So
those are tough things. And the truth is, you could come with me to ask me a particular case where I would say go. Because sometimes it makes sense to say that too. You have to, these are subtle things, but this, you can see what you're weighing here. You're weighing both the personal of the individual, which is complex. An individual is sad, but an individual can be sad and happy at the same time. I mean, that's for real. That's how we are. And then there's the community side of it. So these are not simple things to adjudicate. You know, it's very hard to make blanket rules.
I forget if we've ascertained exactly what the period of time that someone is in avail. Is this the Shloshim?
Well, here we're it is true. Here we are talking simply about the 7-day mourning period. Okay? Where we're talking simply about the 7-day mourning period. Anything that we do beyond that, these sort of extrapolations that we're making out of that are extrapolations, but they're not matters of law per se. We're talking specifically 7 days.
When they talked about bringing the offering, they said with an agent.
Correct.
Is that all offerings are with an agent?
No.
Does that have anything?
No, it's not clear. I wouldn't have translated it that way. I understand why they translate it that way, but it's a problem for the commentators, because the commentators don't understand why it says that, precisely for what you said. Because this is not a necessary thing. You don't necessarily send things with an agent. So the commentators wonder, well, does it say that? It doesn't even say it. It implies it, right, that of course, the person couldn't go himself. And this is saying, even with an agent, he couldn't go. Even with an agent. Okay? But that becomes a part of rich commentary, because it's not really clear why it's phrased in that way. Because a person can. A person doesn't normally send things with an agent. And it's not clear why the agent is involved, if an agent is involved, because I'm not sure it says that either. It says, Eino mishaleach korbanotav. So I don't really know what that means.
Because it's a send? Because the mishaleach is
it? It doesn't.
Which is the word that
mishaleach means to send. But to tell you the truth, I don't think mishaleach means to send.
Oh, because it's sent means you don't take it.
It could mean to gift.
I'll tell you what it means. The Hebrew word sholeach, lishloach in the kal, means to send. Lishal, to send. In the PL, shalach, or that's what this is, it says mishaleach, like midaber, does not mean to send. You know what it means? I'll tell you what it means. That's what I mean. I'll give you a better example. It's from the Parsha these days. Shalach et ami. When the Torah says Moses goes to the Pharaoh and he says to the Pharaoh, Shalach et ami. How do we translate that to English? Let my people go. Okay? So to let go is completely different than to send. Okay? So that's what I think really the sense of it is here. Avil eno mishaleach korbanotav. He doesn't let
He doesn't release it.
Correct. And the truth is, when you bring a sacrifice, you do release it. It's an animal. So, and you give it to the Kohen.
The word l'shaleach also appears in divorce and giving a gift.
Correct.
Which
is the same.
Send away.
I don't know whether it means that. I think it's a release.
It's
called get peturi. Well, I don't like that send away because you're sending the woman away. You're releasing her from her obligations to the marriage. Right? You're releasing. It says get peturin lach. Get peturin lach. It says in the get, right? Which I think is really a release. I think a release is closer to our sense of what it is.
Were any of these bird offerings?
Were any of them bird offerings? No. You can't bring shlamim, I don't think, of a bird offering. It's usually a lamb. What I think, the one I'm not sure of is whether there may be shlamim. No, that's different. The thing that I'm not sure about, as you ask it, is whether you could have a grain offering for shlamim. But that's bread that accompanies an animal. You have to bring the animal.
You must bring the bread.
Correct. You can't bring the bread without the animal. Mm-hmm. You have the animal, and then you bring the bread with it, but you can't bring the bread without it.
What about drinks?
Drinks is different. Drinks, the libations, you're required to bring wine, but that wine is not drunk by the people. That wine is poured on the altar.
It's poured on the altar.
So that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm not sure that the English is correct here, that it's descended by an agent. I'm not sure that that's what it's talking about. I would translate it differently. That's what
I thought. It depended on your economic status. If you could afford a...
Depends. Some things yes, some things no. No, because it's the obligations that depend upon an economic status. We can't require somebody to bring something he can't afford. That's why we have a series of steps, since we're requiring you to do it. If we're making something voluntary, it's just different. It's different. You want to give, of course, a person, which I said, I'm not sure, maybe that you can bring the menachot, which is a grain offering, which is, of course, the least expensive of all the offerings. That's a very inexpensive offering to have to bring.
I wonder whether the term shlamim has something to do that the animal is whole without blemish.
I don't think so. It's a nice drasha. It's nice, but I don't think so, because that's ein bo mum, is what the Torah says, and I think the shlamim relates more to the giver than to the animal itself. I think that what we just saw here is really very good. Both these explanations are really very good. They have to do with the nature of the giver and the emotions felt by a person in a certain state, which is a state usually of thanksgiving. Okay? Good. Let's keep going. All right. Now the Gemara, of course, goes on and does what it has been doing regularly. Menudeh. Mahu sheyishalach korbanotav. What about somebody who is under a ban? Does that person give his sacrifices, his shlamim? Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Come in here. Kol otan shanim shayu Yisrael b'midbar. All those years that the Jews were in the wilderness, minudim hayu. They were under a ban during the 40 years after they were told they had to wander for that period of time. So they were under a ban. Vishilchu korbanotehem. And they sent their sacrifices. We know that they gave shlamim. Every once in a while the Torah mentions the shlamim. The shlamim are brought during the time in the desert. So we would learn from that, as we have seen this previously. We've made reference to the Jews in the desert. Last one we saw was with sex. Remember that? Mm-hmm. They were under a ban, and obviously their population kept increasing. So we know that they had sexual relations under a ban. So we said, well, maybe we can learn from that. Here it is. We know that they brought their korbanot. All right, but you remember what we said the last time? So here it says, Amar le Abaye. Right. Abaye says to Rav Yosef, V'dilme minudeh l'shamayim shanei dekil. Maybe somebody who is under a ban from heaven is in a more lenient condition. In a more lenient condition. Right. Why more lenient? That is to say, when you are under a ban from heaven, namely when you were wandering in the desert for 40 years, God was lenient. Wow. He let you, even though you were under a ban, he let you do things like this. He let you bring your korbanot. You could bring your shalamim. Right? We saw exactly the same reason last week with sex. Right? That was exactly Abaye's response then. Abaye said, maybe during the time that he was in the desert, it was, you know, because it was under a ban from heaven, it was more lenient, and therefore they could have sex. Whereas a normal menudeh, no. Here too. Whereas a normal menudeh cannot bring his sacrifices. Okay? Maybe. But you remember we saw this kind of argument once before. Remember? What was it? Wasn't it with wrapping of the head? Right?
It was the greeting.
Oh, was it the greeting? The greeting? And in that case, it was Machmir. In that case, it said, when you were under a ban from heaven, it was more stringent. Not that it was more lenient, it was more stringent. Last week, we saw same kind of reasoning, but the opposite. It was more lenient. Where is it?
It's on page 15A3. The left-hand English column.
Okay. Where is this? Left-hand English column, 15A3.
The Gemara deflects this.
The Gemara.
More stringent.
Deflects the proof. Amar le Abaye, dilma minudeh l'shamayim, shanei dechamir. Right? Maybe the minudeh who is minudeh from heaven is more stringent. So the first time it said more stringent. The second time it said more lenient. The third time it says more lenient. So the reaction, if you remember, at the end of the last class was, abaya. You can't have it both ways. Which way do you want to do it? So here it's exactly the same thing. Kill, more lenient, v'hamart chamir. But you already told us the first time around that it was more stringent, being under a ban from God. All right? Sapuki misaf galei umadchele. What happened was that Abaya wasn't sure. Abaya was obviously not sure whether it was more stringent or was more lenient. And he used whichever one he wanted. And so he therefore puts the other guy off with whatever one he chose. Which of course disqualifies the whole proof. Because it's not, now we can't really learn anything from it. Okay?
We could learn that it's just different.
Yeah, we could be like that too. Choose whatever.
Yeah, but we wouldn't know which way to go. We wouldn't know whether we can learn.
Well, we can't learn exactly.
Right. So we were looking to know about the Minudah. So as you will see, for example, it's on the next page in English, 16A1. Look at 16A1. Look at the diagram on the right-hand side of the page in the bottom. Okay? Look at the mourner's side. Mourner. Forbidden, 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 obligated, obligated, obligated. All right? 100% for the mourner. Next one. Minudeh. Forbidden, unresolved, unresolved. Permitted, forbidden, permitted, unresolved, 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 unresolved. Okay? And this was just the last two that we said. Sending sacrifices and marital relations, both of them are unresolved as far as the mourner goes, as far as the minudeh is concerned. So in that case, and the halacha is, as I said to you before, when you have something that's unresolved in these cases, it always goes to the more lenient of the possibilities. Whatever is considered more lenient is what the law is. Okay?
I have a side question.
Mm-hmm.
About the Menudeh, Am Yisrael Menudeh Bamidbar, where it's coming from?
Yeah.
It's a good question. I don't know for sure. It's not as if there is language that says exactly that. But I think that you see here, we've already seen, and we'll see more tonight, a concept of Nidui. That Nidui involves people being separated from the authority, from the judge, the chief judge. Okay? Where is the separateness of the chief judge here?
I always thought it's differently. You know, I saw the 40 years in the desert as kurituch, as putting the people together.
Because you're an Israeli.
Or the old people to die and only the bone free people to get into the country. I see it's completely different. That's the reason.
In the Torah, it is a punishment. It is a punishment for the generation that came out of Egypt because they did not have sufficient faith in the God who took them out of Egypt that he would take them into the land, right? Because of their lack of faith. When the spies went out and the spies brought back a bad report about the land and they thought that we are like grasshoppers in their eyes, that whole incident resulted in a punishment to be sure that all of those people, all the people of that generation would never go into the land. Right? That's the way the Torah talks about it. Now, in addition to that, keep in mind that from that point on, there is a limitation on the divine word toward the people as well. Right? God stops talking to the people. It's considerably after Mount Sinai. But God cuts himself off. God cuts himself off. And that is part of the psychology of Nidui, is that you are cut off by having abrogated authority, by having said to the authority, you are no authority, which in effect is what the people are saying. You know, you said you were going to be a deliverer. You said you were going to do this. We don't believe it. In effect, that's what they're saying once they raise doubts. That is the archetype of Nidui. Right? Nidui is that. It is where somebody spurns the authority of the court. And of course, God is the chief judge. So that's why it's used as a model. So even though, again, it's not specifically discussed in those terms, that's where I think it comes from. Okay?
So, yes. So if a person is banned, is under a ban by God, how do the other people know about it?
Well, in the case of the Torah, there was a source that told them that. Right? It was God spoke to Moses.
That's in the desert.
Correct. So, and that is the only case, I think. Well, you could probably make some other cases, but I don't know that those cases are actually made. Wait, let me think. No, you will see.
Yeah, the drought.
You will see there are other instances, some of which we're going to meet here in the Gemara, which are considered by the rabbis to be a case of divine nidui, where God puts some people, at least, under a ban. You'll see that in the text.
And then under what circumstances in the Torah does God regain his relationship? That's the part where...
Correct. It depends. It's not good. It's something to be avoided. I don't want to answer too much because more of this is going to be fleshed out in the Talmud that's coming up. Okay? All right. You'll see what's not good about it. It's not good at all. Like in the desert, what happened to you? You died.
Right.
So it's not good.
That's very dangerous.
You better believe it.
Of God to cut himself off. Oh, now how do you know that anybody's going to be paying attention when you come back, when you tune back in?
So why does God do that?
I don't know. That's very scary. And also, you know, are we indeed doing now?
Hope not.
I'm
more than that. We're not.
We're doing a lot of talking.
We're not. But the logic behind it, to the extent that it is logic, this is divine wrath. It's the bigger question of how could God be angry, right?
I don't mind that he's angry. I'm just curious that he might leave.
But there's such beautiful psalms written about that. I mean, it's all through the psalms.
Correct.
You turn your face away, and I tremble, and
correct.
I am bereft.
And do not turn your face away from me. Okay. That's our anxiety. That's the anxiety. Now, and you can't have that anxiety without a pretty good example of how bad it could be. Right?
Or that it might end.
Or what? Oh, you mean that the whole thing would end?
No, that the nidui might end.
Oh, that there would be a way out of it.
Right.
Right. That's also true.
No, we did occupy the land.
Right. Right. I mean, the situation changed. And there was a generation, that's the generation you're referring to, that went into the land and that was perfectly prepared. I just read a story. What did I... Whom did I read? This was... Oh, maybe some of you read it too. I don't know what it was. It was within the last week. Somebody who wrote about the difference of the people in the desert and the difference of the people going into the land. And all of this was really to reflect on Zionism. It was part of the context of modern Zionism, because that's what we think about, you know. There was a generation that, some of the generation didn't make it to the land. Those who made it, you know, it wasn't really all theirs, but it was for the next generation. It was for the people who were born in the land, who conquered the land, you know, and the generation of those who came out of Egypt couldn't be the conquerors. They didn't have it in them. They were slaves. They couldn't deal with what you'd have to deal with for those things. So I just for some reason I can't remember where it was. You read the same thing? So maybe it was, I don't think it was one of the weird things I read. I think it was a generally read thing. So I read this.
Jerusalem Post.
Maybe it was the Jerusalem Post. Somebody read an article in the Jerusalem Post. Maybe that's what it was. Or maybe some politician made this statement. I'm not sure. So there was a problem with what was said. And that is, it's very, one of the wonderful books to read. If you really want to spend, take it on a summer vacation, is to read the book of Joshua. It's a very interesting book of the Bible to read. It helps a lot if you want to understand current political realities, to understand, to read Joshua, Shoftim, and about half of, through the stories of David and fighting the Philistines. Because, you read that stuff and you say, definitely nothing new has ever happened.
Oh, it's the same.
It's all the same. It's all the same story. So, and, as if you should really want to have a policy to solve these problems, you read the stories and you see that the Philistines just, you change the dots in the words and you still have the same thing. I mean, you don't even have to change the words. It's the same words. Palestinian, Philistines, exactly the same Hebrew word. Nothing ever changes. But to read the book of Joshua is very interesting because the book of Joshua isn't what whoever it was that made this statement said it was. He looked at it like an Israeli, that this was the new generation and claiming the land and doing all the things that you have. And there's no doubt that's a part of it. But there's another side to the book of Joshua, which is that in the book of Joshua, the people really were loyal to God. They were loyal to God and to his word. And that keeps being said in the book of Joshua. And, of course, that's not relevant to those who are writing in the modern context because that produces its own problems. But that's a major piece of I think, the message of the book, that this transformation that took place was a transformation not only on a personal level of providing good fighting forces and people who didn't have the baggage of Egypt, but there's actually a religious transformation.
Yeah, but Joshua period is a very short period. It's a very, very short period.
Correct, correct. It's downhill from there. It's downhill from there. Correct. We'll get to that in just a second. As a matter of fact, it's a part of our reading tonight. Okay, let's go on. Now we're up to the Metzorah. Mahu sheyishalach korbanotav. Should the Metzorah, can he send his korbanot? Tashma, come in here. Detanya, de'acharei tohorato. Here's a baraita, and the baraita is rather complicated. This Baraita brings another section of the book of Ezekiel where one of the themes of the book of Ezekiel is the restoration of the sacrificial cult. Ezekiel was a prophet of the exile. He was exiled in Babylonia. Okay, and part of the vision of Ezekiel is a vision of reinstituting and rebeginning the cult in the temple. Okay, so it's both useful for some insights into what the cult was like, because it's at a later period of time. Right? This is the end of the First Temple period. So you learn a little bit, or you think maybe you'll learn. But one of the problems with the book of Ezekiel is that every once in a while he says things that don't make sense. That as much as we know about the cult, these things don't seem to fit. They seem to be a little bit off the wall. So there are a few ways you can deal with it. You can say, we were wrong. Everything else we thought we knew was not correct. One possibility. Another possibility, he was wrong. All right? Or, third possibility, how could he possibly be wrong? How could we possibly be wrong? He's right, and we're right, and what he must be talking about was the way it will be in the future. Right? The future will be a little different from the way it was in the past. Right? So those are all reasonable possibilities. In religion, it's very good. Only in the newspapers and modern people, every 3 days I see another article about whether religion makes sense. Is it the theory of evolution, or what's it's they're arguing against evolution?
Intelligent.
Intelligent. I can't make any intelligence out of intelligence design or evolution at this stage. I don't understand what any of it is talking about. Because the people who are talking about it seem to be talking past each other. Everybody talks past. It's as if nobody likes the other one, and so they won't say things that anybody else... You can't have a conversation with anybody. So that seems to be the way these things go. So it's not at all in real religion. Real religion always knows that there are lots of possibilities. Real religion is not like fundamental. You have fundamentalism, which are the anti-intelligent design, fundamentalism, which is the intelligent design. The real possibility is you're probably right and you're probably right, you know? And so each is a little piece of the truth, and the real truth is what we're hoping. That's why we need Eliyahu and Avi to come and tell us what the real... So that's the way we tend to work. So this piece now is from the book of Ezekiel, the Tanya, as it is taught. V'achare Torato, right? He is talking about, apparently, about... Well, let's see. I think we can read the... Let's just read 45 down at the bottom, so we'll read the long quote so we can see the whole quote altogether. The El Met Adam Lo Yavo, right, the priest, the Kohen, should not come in contact with a dead person, L'tam'ah, to become defiled, to become tameh, Ki'im la'av u'la'em, except for a father and a mother, u'levein u'levat, a son or a daughter, u'la'ach u'le'achot, lo'ayata le'ishitama, to a brother or a sister who was not married. V'achare Torato shivat yamin. That's the same as in the Torah. The Torah says the same thing in Parashat Amor. V'achare Torato shivat yamin yisperulo. After he has become purified, they shall count for him 7 days. Uv'yom bo'o el ha-kodesh el ha-chatzer ha-pnimit. And when he comes into the holy sanctuary, to the inner courtyard, lisharet bakodesh, to do his job as a kohen, to serve in the holy place, yakriv chatato, he shall bring his sin offering. We don't know why you should bring a sin offering, and none of this, we don't know this from the Torah. This is one of those places where the Torah says nothing about this. And you never bring a sin offering because you want to. The only reason you bring a sin offering is the Torah requires you to. So this is a good example of one of the problems in Ezekiel. Nu'um Hashem Elokim. Okay? Now, because this passage has certain internal inconsistencies to it, the rabbis never let any inconsistency bother them. Instead, they make it more inconsistent. And they just say, if it seems inconsistent, it must really be talking about two or three totally different situations. That way, if you want inconsistency, I'll give you inconsistency. All right? And that's what happens here. This whole baraita shows how a few problems are not problems because they're really talking about totally different things. And they're all sort of brought together in one verse or two verses here when really they could be parsed much better. So here you say, V'achare Torato. When it says that the Kohen became Tameh, and he has to become pure and in order to begin his duties again, right, in order to bring the sacrifices, right? What does that mean? Achar prishato min amet. This is talking about when he separates from the corpse, okay? And then there's a seven-day separation, a seven-day period of separation, which we know from the Torah, but Ezekiel just leaves that out. He leaves out that detail. So there's now a seven-day separation. Shivat yamim yisparulo. You might have thought that this 7 days is referring to the 7 days I just said two sentences ago. No, not talking about that. Elu shivat yamei sifiro. These are an additional 7 days. Well, you're saying, well, why would they ever have an additional 7 days? Torah only tells us about the first 7 days. Oh, there is a situation where you could have an additional 7 days. When? What if the Kohen were also a Metzora? If the Kohen came into contact with death, then he has a 7 days. And if he is also a Metzora and he gets better from his Tzara'at, he also has another 7 days. So obviously, this simple verse must be talking about all of these things. All right? Obviously. Elu Shivat Yemei Sefiro. Okay? And so we have one period of 7 days for the tumah of the corpse, and one period of 7 days for tzara'at. Of tzara'at. Uvi yom bo'o el ha-kodesh. Now we're getting to the last piece of the verse. When he comes into the holy sanctuary, el ha-chatzer ha-pnimit, to the inner courtyard, l'sharet ba-kodesh, yakriv chatato. Right? He shall bring his sin offering. What kind of sin offering is this? There's no reason for him to bring a sin offering. He didn't do any sins. Right? So this is now a third situation. We have two situations so far. One of tumah of emet, one of tumah of tzara'at, and now, because this doesn't make sense, we'll tell you, it's really referring to yet something else. What is that? It is referring to the sin offering of the tenth of an ephah. What was that? That was Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That was an offering that was brought as a sin offering when somebody started out as a new Kohen. The first time you bring any offerings, you're new to the business. You come into the family business. Right? First initiation into the family business is that you bring this tenth of an ephah of a grain offering. Okay? So, and that's a chatat. So this person now must have been coming the first time, recovering from corpse tumor and from tzara'at. Right? So these are the three situations. Right? Rabbi Shimon Omer Uviyom Bo'o Yakriv. On the day of his entry, he shall bring. Oh, so we learned just now that this guy's got these three different things going on at once. So the final thing that goes on is that he begins his initiation into the rite of the kohuna, right? Of the priesthood. That's after he's brought those, he's done, that's after he's had the two purifications.
Oh, each time he's got to stop and get be purified.
Correct. Because there are different purifications, and the tzara'at is a three-day and a seven-day purification during the tzara'at. Oh. Okay, so what this has implied, therefore, is that in order for this guy to get started, among the things that he had to do was to finish the tzara'at purification. And remember the question we just asked before. We got into this whole baraita because we wanted to know whether somebody who had tzara'at can bring his sacrifices. And we've just read a baraita which says that the guy's got to get better, all the time has got to pass, he has to get rid of the tzara'at, he has to be purified from it, and then he comes. Ipso facto, I learn. Beforehand, you couldn't bring it.
Yeah, but this is only for the other Kohen.
No, so this
but
is what you...
less than 10% of the people.
Yeah, but at least that does bring us... That's a pretty good... That's the best we could find. Okay, Bizman... So it says, Bizman shera'ui l'viya, when he is qualified to come into the holy place, ra'ui l'hakrava, he is qualified to bring his sacrifice. Bizman she'eino ra'ui l'viya, when he is not qualified for going into the sacred place, eino ra'ui l'hakrava, he is also not qualified to bring the sacrifice. What?
The word bi'ah. The sexual intercourse?
It could, but that's not the way it's used here.
When you're allowed to do this, then you're allowed to do that. No?
True. I'm not sure. Have to look at the list. You have to look at the list here and see.
The first thing that came to mind.
Okay. But bia is used in different ways. Okay? In fact, it is the same. They're both forbidden. They are both forbidden. But remember last week we had a different explanation for that. That of the communicative nature of a physical disease. Maybe that's it and maybe this is it. I don't know. Okay?
I was just wondering, you know, if without the rest of the explanation, if I saw this, I would make up a reasoning about why one column matches the other or their attitude towards the, you know, lepers or that would not at all follow what we've just read. Do you think that the arguments were around about justification? I mean, maybe they had an attitude about the Mitzorah, and this was a way of getting around it, not being direct. Or is it that really the arguments are derived like this, and they are the way they thought direct, you know, absolutely?
Mm-hmm. I would say you may be right, and you may be wrong. I have no idea. I honestly don't know, because that's one of the fun things about reading this. An awful lot of scholars will say one way or the other. You'll have the more traditional scholars on the one hand who will say, obviously they're proving it from the text. You idiot, you don't see that this is in the text? It's so obvious. If the rabbi said it, it's true. That's one extreme. Some of you probably had teachers like this at one time or another, you know, who would do this kind of explanation. It's an authority. If the authority said it, obviously that's what it says, and it's your fault if you don't see how logical it is. You know, your logic may not be that good. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the whole thing is the other. It's all a justification for something that already existed. Okay? In my humble opinion, I have no idea which is right. I wouldn't be comfortable going one way or the other. I'm right in the middle. It tends to be the way I am in a lot of things. I just have no idea which is the correct explanation.
Probably sections where you suspect it's more one.
Correct. Sometimes I have the feeling that this, like in a baraita like this, first of all, this is a, if to the extent that this is logical, anything could be logical. And this is about as unlogical as anything can be. What kind of logic is this? In all honesty, you won't tell anybody that I told you that. Because you're not allowed to say things like that. But frankly, it doesn't seem too logical to me. On the other hand, how am I to say? These kinds of things, maybe we only have a partial text in the transmission of the text, left out a lot of steps in between. I don't know. I just find it fun.
But they have Greek logic as a model.
Yes, which
is...
Like
nobody thought logic.
Oh, yes. Oh, they... Gemara is full of tremendous logic. Absolutely. Which is one of the reasons that I think that a good argument can be made that this is often very logical and very compelling. But I can't always, with a straight face, argue that too strong.
Rabbi, I'm just surprised that they permit a tzaruah, even if he's at the end of a disease, to come into the Holy of Holies.
It's actually an interesting problem. And the commentators here, I don't understand why the commentators say what they do. There's a comment in the English here that says... that the Rishonim, the early commentators, don't understand this whole question. Because, largely for what you just said. Or, why do they have to go through this gerrymandering kind of an argument? It should be obvious. You have a holy space. Somebody who has tzaraat is tameh. That person is ritually impure. How could you have ever thought that that person could go into the holy space? It doesn't make any sense. So that this whole argument makes no sense at all. Why would you even ask the question? That's what the early commentators say. All right? But I don't agree with that. Because there's the Talmud in Masechet Zivachim, which is your final initiation, if you want to step into the world of another world, is the Talmud of Zivachim, which is the massive Masechet about the sacrificial system. One of the best of all the Talmudic tractates. It's just another world. There is a whole section in there on this problem. I remember reading it. I was absolutely fascinated by it. You know why it is? Let me tell you. The Metzora has to bring a sacrifice. There's a sacrifice. He has to bring some offering. Okay? And in fact, the Talmud figures out a way that he can be both in and outside the temple at the same time. You know, that's
according.
Leave it to the Talmud. The Talmud knows the problem and says, of course he can't go in. But, no, some places are partly in and partly out. So we create a kind of a mechitza, and he goes here, and the Kohen puts his hand on the animal from one side, he puts his hand on the animal from the other side, and he's not in and he's not out, and that's okay. That's
it's like
enough.
The women Torah readers of Shira
Hadashah. It's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's a wonderful example. The women Torah readers of Shira Hadashah in Jerusalem, they're not on... The table for reading of the Torah is right in the middle. Half of it is on one side of the mechitza, half of it is on the other side of the mechitza. So, and this is a modern way to do it.
It's a brilliant solution.
Correct. Which is exactly the Talmudic type of solution. It's the way the Talmud solved the problem of the Metzora coming into the temple as well. So I think that though your question is a good question and the early commentators said the same thing, I don't understand why they didn't resort to the earlier piece of the Talmud in Zvachim.
Isn't there a big ambivalence about the whole concept, though? It seems to me, I've mentioned this before, that when we see this mentioned, there's language that indicates that there's a problem with it, but it's always directly denoting a connection with God at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the cases of Moshe, it's always God has actually done this, so there's that sense that there's a numinous quality to it, that at the same time they haven't quite figured out on what side of the line it goes to.
I'm not sure I understand you, Jay.
Okay. The sense, I feel that this isn't a sense where the tuma of the issue is entirely in line with other cases where there's a clearer distinction between what's tamei and what isn't, and that they haven't quite figured out what to do with this concept. Because I mean, in the cases of Moshe, I mean, the result of his physical contact, so to speak, with Hashem, always seems to result in this.
Mm-hmm. In tumah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But with this specific symptom, with the Mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I
but
see.
But there's sometimes sense that they haven't figured out if this is a good thing or a bad thing.
I see.
Is this a sign of something special, or is this a sign of something negative?
I think it's bad. I mean, I think in the text it's seen as punishment, and it is a form of punishment. The only case where maybe it isn't that is in the case where who puts it in? Moshe puts his hand in just to check early on, right?
Yeah,
as a proof. There, I don't think it has any pejorative side to it. Maybe. Okay.
You said that the Metzorah can come with Zvachim and they put in Chitza and a big worker. What about if Metzorah want to go to the temple and he doesn't bring...
Not allowed. Can't do it.
So it's only when Shlamim, so it goes back to the Shalem.
Right. The, it's an interesting problem, because if you have a state of impurity and that state involves bringing an offering, the logical problem is that you can't bring the offering. Why can't you bring the offering? Because to bring the offering, you have to be pure.
And you're not pure.
But to get pure, you have to bring the offering. So that's a catch-22 problem. And that's why the Gemara will come up with solutions. Gemara hardly ever leaves it at a catch-22. We usually come up with a solution. Okay? Where it involves a piece of Torah law. Not when it involves something else, but when it involves Torah law, we usually solve this problem with a creative solution.
Isn't your conclusion in this discussion that the Mitzorah cannot bring a sacrifice?
Correct.
And Zvachim, not only can he, but they lay out the details.
Correct.
How is it that it came up twice with two different conclusions? Or are they talking about a different situation?
It was the Minudeh. Right. Twice in what context? In our context that we're studying it?
It's in Zvachim.
This is the Shlamim. This is a context of a voluntary offering. The other is the required offerings. Okay, that's again that difference. Okay, let's go on. Now we're going to enter a piece of Talmud, which we will study for the next 18 minutes. And we will go as far as we go with it, and then I'm going to skip. I'll tell you why. This next piece of Talmud is quite interesting, as everything is, but it's off the subject. It will take us away from the laws of mourning. And what it is a discussion of judicial procedure, which for you lawyers especially, you will find interesting. We have lawyers. There are certain precedents for judicial procedure, and this will now come out as a result of the Gemara deciding to spend time on the subject of the Minudeh. You have, and I have, sort of talked about this, but I didn't want to talk too much about it. It is somebody who is sort of excommunicated, but sort of not excommunicated. There's a variety of issues of the person who's put under a ban. At this point in the text, because in fact all of the uncertainty and the desire for clarification that you have, because this term is not clear enough to us, the Gemara is now going to spend about 2 pages of Gemara on this term, and giving us the biblical sources, and we'll come to understand more and more about what this subject of being under a ban is. Because this is really quite lengthy, and because it's off the subject, and I'm afraid that we may not get through the laws of mourning, we'll do as much as we do now, and then I'm going to pick up again on 17b.
Why don't we wait till the lawyers come in and skip?
Well, until 17b. Then we're going to skip to 17b. Okay? So let's do some of this now, and we'll see how it is. Amar Rava. Rava says, Minalan demishadrin shlicha deveidina. From where, from what biblical source do we know that we send an agent of the court in order to umazminan leiladina, in order to summon the defendant to appear for a judgment? Now, here you're dealing with procedure.
Notice.
All right? Correct. This is service and notice. Do you need notice? What is the nature of the notice? Do you need service in order to bring a person to, and what is the definition of service? All right? These questions are asked, and you will see there are biblical precedents from which we derive the answers. Dichtiv, as it is written, Vayishlach Moshe likro ledatan ula'averam B'nai Eliyav. Now, this is the section of the Torah. It's Numbers 16:12. Neither. See if you can guess. Okay. I'll read a little bit. I'll read it in the Hebrew. Tatana Aviram.
Oh, it's Korach.
Yes, exactly. It's Parshat Korach. It's Parshat Korach. This is the 16th chapter of Numbers. The rebellious Korach stands up with his crowd. Vayakumu lifnei Moshe. They rise up against Moses. Va'anashim ibnei Yisrael. Chamishim u'matayim. 250 nisiei eda, chiefs of the community. Kru'emo edan sheshem. Important people. Vayikalu al Moshe. And they gather against Moses. Vi'ala Haron, against Aaron. Vayomru aleihem. And they said to them, Rav lachem, kol ha'eda kulam kadoshim. You are too much. They are saying to Moses and Aaron, you're too much. It's enough of you. Ki kol ha'eda, the whole community, all of them are kadoshim, they're all holy. Uvetocham Hashem, and in their midst is God. Umadu titnasu al ka'al Hashem. And why do you lift yourselves up against, over the community of the Lord? All right, this is an attack on Moses and Aaron. Vayishma Moshe, Moses heard. Vayipol al panav, and he fell on his face. Vayedaber al kol, so that means he prayed. He fell on his face to God. Vayedaber, that's by vayipol al panav. Those of you who've been in the davening the last 2 days, that's tachanun. That's tachanun. Tachanun, we said. Vayedaber al korach, and he said to Korach, the el kol adato, and his whole community, Lemor, boker v'yoda Hashem. In the morning, God will make it known. Et asher lo v'et akodesh, who is on his side and who is holy. V'hikriv elav, and who shall be drawn to him. V'et asher yifchar bo yakriv elav, and whoever God chooses will bring an offering. We'll do the work. Right? We'll yakriv elav. We'll bring the offering. Zot asu k'chu lechem aktot. All right, now go and do this. Take fire pans. Right? Moses is setting them up. Let's see who, in fact, is given permission to bring this stuff. Vayomar Moshe el Korach. Moses says to Korach, Shim'una. Now, of course, what is Korach doing? Korach is rebelling. He is rebelling against Moses and Aaron, but he is also rebelling against the source of authority. Right? This is another instance of a nidui. Right? We are seeing the setup here for somebody who is going to go into nidui. Vayomer Moshe al Korach, Shim'una b'nei Levi. Listen, you children of Levi, because the Korachites were Levites. Hama'at mikem ki'iv dil Elokei Yisrael. Isn't it enough that God has separated you from the community of Israel, la'akriv etchem elav, to draw him near to you, to draw you near to him, la'avod et avodat mishkan Hashem, to do the service of the Lord's place, and so on. Lachain, therefore, ata v'chol adatcha, you and your whole congregation, hanoadim al Hashem, who are gathered together now against the Lord. Okay. Al Hashem v'Aaron mahu kitalinu alav, and Aaron, why are you complaining about him? Right? What is he that you are complaining about him? Vayishlach Moshe likro ledatan ulaaviram. And Moses then vayishlach. Right? Not yishalach. Yishlach. And there it clearly means, and he sent for Datan and Aviram. All right? B'nei Eliyah, Vayomer, Vayomru, and they said, Lo na'aleh. He serves them, and they refuse to be served. All right? They will not allow it. All right? Go back to the text here. How do we know that you send somebody? Vayishlach, and Moses sent. Right? Moses actually sends for them. Umazminan ladina dichti vayishlach Moshe likro ledatan ulaviram b'nei Eliyav. Right? Moses sends for Datan and Aviram. Uminalan demazminan ladina. And how do we know that the court summons the defendant to appear for judgment? How do we know that? Dichti, Vayomer Moshe El Korach, Ata Vekol Adarcha. You and your whole assembly shall go before God tomorrow. Okay? They are all summoned to appear before the judge. Who's the judge?
God.
It's God. Okay? That's the whole structure here. Moses is not doing anything. He says, you're coming to court tomorrow. You are summoned to appear tomorrow before the judge. All right? Then he has to serve Datan and Aviram because they're not present. Okay? The next is Lekamai Gav Rabba. How do we know that you're supposed to mention that it is so-and-so the judge that you have to appear before? You must mention the judge's name. Now, I'm going to ask you whether we do this in American law. You have to actually mention the judge's name because it says, Lifnei Hashem. You have to tell Datan and Aviram and Korach that they are appearing before a judge and his name is Hashem. You want to impress them with the weight of this court. What do we do in American law?
Generally, you don't know the judge.
But you say to a court of... Or
whom this and this. Which court?
You say which court. All, it's, in effect, the same thing.
Is that, certain times when you do know the judge, you would put the judge.
You would put the judge.
It's not
necessary. You know it's the highest court, too, right?
Uh-huh.
You know the level of the court, right?
Yeah, but you could have a change of personnel. It's the court that matters, not the personality.
It's the court. Okay.
Well, in certain Supreme courts, court. You can have a change of personnel. In other courts, you can't have a change of personnel.
Like in this court. Okay.
Right. All right. Same thing.
Okay. At Uflanya. How do we know that the agent informs the defendant, you and the plaintiff? Uflanya. Right? In the summons, it has to be said who is the defendant and who is the plaintiff. Both those things must be included because it says, Ata v'heim v'aharon. Right? You and they, Korach, Datan Aviram, all the Eidah, v'aharon. Right? Aaron is the plaintiff. They're the defendants. Aaron is the plaintiff. Okay?
That would be true in America.
That's also true in American law. It's fascinating here. You derive your judicial procedure, you see, out of these biblical verses. Frankly, I never saw any of that in the biblical verses. I mean, I just never read it that carefully to realize that, in fact, yes, it is interesting that Aaron's name is included. I never saw it from a lawyer's eyes.
Nor did I.
Okay? And here, this is reading it from the lawyer's eyes, the judge's eyes. All right? It goes on. Dekav inan zimna. How do we know that when you summon someone to the court, you have to say the time? All right? All right? So, dichtiv machar. Because the Torah says tomorrow. Okay, zimna batar zimna. How do we know that you have to, we establish, if a person doesn't come, you have to say another date, fix a second date after the original date? Later on it says, Karu Sham Paro, this is in the story of this is in a totally different place. This is in the latter part of the Bible, the story of the Babylonians, the Pharaoh of Egypt, the Babylonians, and the Jews. Karu Sham Paro Melech Mitzrayim Sha'on Evir Hamoed. Pharaoh does not respond, and Pharaoh will be called again. They called out an excommunication against Pharaoh, the blustery king of Egypt, because he has let the appointed time go by.
Oh, he's in contempt.
All right, he's in contempt, exactly. All right. Umin alan de'i mit pakar bishlicha de'vedina. And from where do we know that if the defendant... let me see a good translation of this. Mit pakad bishlicha. How does it translate it here? Vilifies the court's agent. Yeah, that's right. If the defendant... All right, you sent the agent, and the defendant now speaks ill toward the agent of the court. How do we know? Va'ate v'amar. That it is permissible for the agent to come back to the court and to reveal and repeat exactly what was said by the defendant. La mit chazei kalish nabisha. And it is not considered by the court to be lashon hara. Right? Now, the English translation is not correct here. The English translation is slander. This is not a case of slander. In Jewish law, you have two different issues. One is called lashon hara, the other is slander. Slander means roughly what it does in American law. Lashon hara, I don't think there is an equivalent category, because lashon hara is where you bring a correct... Slander is where you give it, where you give a false report.
So lashon hara can be true.
Lashon hara is true. Lashon hara is true, but it's just awful. And you're not supposed to tell about people awful things about other people, even if they're true. You just don't... So in this case... The person who is the agent of the court has to, in effect, tell the court. Or should he tell the court or should he not tell the court? Is it Lashon Hara or is it not Lashon Hara? That's what we're learning. Well, how do we know that? Dichtiv, because it is written, Ha'ene anashim ha'em tenaker. Okay, as it quotes here, Moses sent forth to summon Datan and Aviram, the sons of Eliad, and they say, we shall not go up, even if you would gouge out the eyes of those men, namely us, we will not go up. And then the Torah says, this distressed Moses greatly. Obviously, Moses heard what they said. He was not there, so he didn't hear what they said by being there. He heard what they said because Vayishlach Moshe, Moses sent somebody, the agent came back and brought a detailed report which pained Moses gravely. Okay? Any questions? This is a little bit of a taste of this whole section of the Talmud, which is going to go into great detail with the procedures and the meanings of a ban of a court. Then the difference between cherem and nidui, which are different severities of ban. And this is the major source we have in the Talmud for the way in which these procedures functioned in rabbinic times. Okay? But as I said, to my mind, this takes us away from the limited time that we have to deal with the laws of mourning. And therefore, when we convene again, we will be on page 17b1.
17b1.
Okay. 17b1.
This implies that if you were treated abusively by someone in the community, just in the course of normal daily activity, rather than acting as a Sharia from the court, you would not repeat what happened to other people.
That's a very interesting question. It might imply that, but it also might not. Yeah, it could imply that. But there could, of course, be all kinds of extenuating circumstances, which we would want to know about, and we would then have to set the limits. Because, you see, this is one case of limits. We understand the logic. The logic is that the court should know that this defendant spurned the will of the court. There's a logical reason for it. We would examine the case that you just brought, and probably we would find ourselves versus to prove another case, which is that certain other things make sense also in our not lashon hara. But we would be forced to do that because we start with a presumption that probably you can't unless you prove otherwise. So it's exactly, and
so that's the general rule, actually. Every case has to stand on its own.
Exactly. Which is why the Chofetz Chaim of Yisrael Meir Cohen wrote an entire book on the subject, or several books, but one book of Halacha on the subject, because it's so complicated. He tried to work it all out halachically into a system so that you could see what the parameters were in order to judge a case.
I'm glad we have a system like that.
Okay.
Thank you. Nonetheless, tell Laura that we went through all of the material.